Please feel free to begin.
All right. Well, thank you, Jean. And thanks, everyone, for joining us today. As Jean mentioned, I'm Jim Rice, and I'll be the session moderator. We have quite a few people logged in from across the country. We also have a really great group of speakers who I'll introduce in just a couple of minutes. But let me first say a couple of words about this ORD Mining and Mineral Workshop series. So EPA's Office of Research and Development has designed this series of webinars to explore some of the challenges that we face working with mining sites and mineral processing facilities. For those of you who might not be familiar, ORD is EPA's research arm, the scientific research arm that helps inform the agency's decisions and policies. So the objective of the seminars is to both inform you, the practitioners and stakeholders, about some of the latest tools and techniques and methods that are available. But also, we want to understand your research needs in the areas of mine and mineral processing. The webinars are designed to be interactive and generate discussion just like you would at a technical conference. So, over the last three mineral processing workshop series, we've asked some questions about the challenges you might face in dealing with mine and mineral processing facility sites. And we got quite a few good answers. And one of the things that we found was that there's a lot of unique issues associated with mining sites, including the fact that these are very large sites, complex, large waste volumes. Some of the sources are located above and below ground across entire watersheds. There's a lot of interaction between groundwater and surface water. Some of the conditions at the site are unstable, and there's a potential for a release at any time. And in general, mining remediation costs can be much higher than a traditional site. So to address the challenges that we see, we need to find more effective ways to address these throughout the project lifecycle. Some of these include innovative characterization and data management tools like we'll talk about today. We've talked about emergency responses and how important they are, and also applying adaptive management strategies to effectively design remediation systems and mitigations. So the series of talks brings together a lot of experts to explore the latest thinking in these areas. So your job is to listen, participate, digest, and respond to that information that we've presented, and give us your feedback and provide us with your questions. So today's session, as Jean mentioned, will focus on the data that we generate and analyze at these huge mine sites. These large old mine sites often have a lot of data, and we're always looking for a better way to analyze the data and present the information that we have to our site teams. Our first presentation is from Katie Dehier and Doug Cushing from CDM Smith, and they'll present us with a tool to analyze large and complex data sets. Katie is a data analytics specialist who brings technology solutions to many different industries. Doug's an expert in digital transformation with extensive experience in artificial intelligence, machine learning, computer vision, and predictive and descriptive analytics. So next, Sohail Al-Abed will look at how we use large complementary data sets to develop effective remediation plans for mining impacted watersheds that have particulate and dissolved metal concerns. Dr. Al-Abed is a research chemist with ORD in Cincinnati, and he's authored or co-authored more than 80 professional papers on a wide range of topics that help inform agency decisions. So I'll be your final speaker of this session and of this series. I'll present a case study of how we developed a three-dimensional visualization of a contaminated site in Colorado and how that visualization was used by the project team. I'm a senior geologist at ICF, and I work with EPA OzReady to provide technology transfer and innovative technology applications to support the needs of the EPA regions. So again, we encourage you to actively participate in these discussions by asking questions and responding to any questions that you see throughout the session. So I'd like to turn the presentation over to our first speakers, Katie and Doug.
Appreciate that. Jim mentioned I'm Doug Cushing with CDM Smith, and I'll be doing an introduction into data analytics as we envision it being applied to abandoned mines and processing facilities. And then Katie will do a live demo to demonstrate some of the capabilities of these tools and the concept of data exploration with these tools. Jim already provided our overview, so I'll move on from there. So I want to set the stage. We hear a ton these days about analytics, big data, data exploration, data visualization, and there's just a huge impact across a whole lot of industries. But there's a lot of scenarios where there is a lot of data, but there's not a lot of information being pulled from that. We want to talk about where data analytics can fit into this field. So there are a lot of fantastic classic tools in environmental investigation and remediation. The data analytics doesn't seek to replace or provide the same sort of insights. So geospatial analysis has been around for decades and is phenomenally powerful for representing the geologic data and analytical chemistry results. And these high-quality verified results are extremely important in investigation. They're actually not the focus of what we're looking to do here. We're looking for data sets that may exist but have been overlooked because they were considered to have limitations, such as not being verified data, such as known missing data or erroneous data. And this is not a different approach to doing statistical analyses like classic statistics packages do or analyses like Excel does. What is in focus here is teasing out trends in these very large, complex, and often dirty or incomplete multidimensional data sets. And when we say large and multidimensional, we're looking at least thousands of rows of data, if not tens of thousands, and we like the data sets wide, at least 10, but often 30 or 50 or 100 columns wide. And we're looking at a concept for directional correctness, not transactional accuracy. So what that means is we drill down, we'll often find missing data, erroneous data, or just unreasonable data. But the great thing about these approaches is if we take just 80% of the data randomly, we'll draw a conclusion. If we randomize it again and analyze it, we'll draw the exact same conclusion. So the conclusions don't change because of the dirtiness of the data. But to overcome the dirtiness, we do need these very large data sets so we're not overly influenced by any single point. We started this process by searching for data sets in the abandoned mine space that we could apply some of these techniques to demonstrate the potential. We did some digging with people who were very familiar with the Bonita Peak area. We went to research institutions like Colorado School of Mines, reached out to different agencies, Park Service, and a number of publicly available abandoned mine land databases, but none of them resulted in content that really would provide us the powerful data analytics demonstration. So I will spoil the conclusion here that at the end of this, we're looking for help from this audience for all the agencies that really want to do these larger data analytics analyses of help and direction for data sets that we may use, and what those are will become clearer as we go through this presentation. And with that, I'd like to turn this over to Katie and have her talk through the data set we used, why it met the criteria for being both large and underutilized, and how we went about assessing it. And then she'll hop into the tool and show you live some of the demonstrations.
Sure. Thanks, Doug. So, yeah, as Doug mentioned, we, in lieu of finding a really compelling, great data set to demonstrate what's possible that's specific to the abandoned mine space in the amount of time we had to put together this presentation, instead, we defaulted to a data set that's another environmental data set. We thought we could draw some parallels. And this data set is focused on sewer overflows, so both sanitary and combined sewer overflows. It's self-reported. It covers one state, over 10 years, 20,000 events. So that comes together about at a million or so data points. And this is NPDES data. Being that it's self-reported, it's relatively dirty. It has free text entry fields. There are formatting issues and things like that. But that wasn't going to stop us from at least analyzing it and trying to draw directionally correct conclusions. So what we did is we did a first pass analysis on the dirty data, just raw as it was, to understand major causes and drivers and see if there was something there, essentially. We found some low-hanging fruit for minor data cleanup opportunities. We did some of those, and those took on the order of less than 8 hours, so less than a day's work to really do some easy minor data cleanup. We reprocessed the data, and we found that the conclusions were so strong that if we were going to present in a public setting, just out of respect for the agencies in the data set, we thought we ought to anonymize the data so as not to call out anyone for things that they've reported in the publicly available data set. So again, we're going to draw some parallels. This isn't a mining database, but it's an environmental data set, and we're going to try to draw some parallels and open your minds to what is possible by providing this demonstration. So with that, we will jump into the demonstration, and you should be seeing my screen here in just a second.
And so as Katie's calling up her presentation screen, I'll just remind everyone that your controls still exist in the upper right corner, so you can use those buttons in the upper right corner of the window where her content appears to increase or enlarge the size of the space, as well as zoom in even further. Katie, I can confirm that we have visuals and we can see your screen.
Okay, fantastic. All right, so what you're seeing on the screen here is a dashboard, and we're going to walk through a series of scenarios so that you can see how we've taken a large, complex, and dirty data set and used it to generate insight that is essentially at your fingertips when put in the right format. But first, I want to walk you through everything that you see on the screen so that it all comes together and makes sense before we start to interact with the data and draw some conclusions. So in the top left, we are looking at a geographic view of sewer overflows by postal code. And you'll notice here, we're looking at the UK. So I mentioned that we anonymized the data. We actually took the geo points for the one state in the US, and we shifted them over to the UK. So they're still in the same place in proportionate to one another, but they just shifted over to a less obvious location or less personal location. So on the map, you will see a lot of bubbles. They're different colors and different sizes. The bubble size indicates the volume of gallons associated with overflow events that occurred in that particular postal code throughout the entire data set. So right now, we're looking at 10 years of data since I haven't applied any filters. So this bubble is bigger than all the rest. It has many more millions of gallons associated with it and all the overflows that have happened here in this location. The color of the bubbles, as the scale suggests here, indicates the number of overflows that have occurred in a particular location. So the bigger and the more red a bubble gets, the worse it is and the more we ought to look at it. And the smaller and the more blue it gets, by comparison, is not as bad. Of course, when we're talking about sewer overflows, you know, one is bad. But if we're talking about fewer or more, that's where this analysis can help us hone in on problem areas. So I'll come back to this in a minute, but I want to draw your attention to the visualization below it, which I'm hovering over with my mouse, which is just going to show us the number of overflows by year. And again, since I haven't applied any filters, this is total for the entire data set. We're looking at about 10 years of data. And to add dimensionality to the trend by year, we have a two-dimensional heat map that looks at the trend of overflows by month across the top and then years down the side. So one box in the heat map will give us a year and a month and the number of overflows that happen. So we can really start to see either more about what happened within a particular year, just in a glance, or we can look at certain months within several years across the span of the whole data set. And that's where analyzing seasonality can really come into play. And we don't have to do any statistical analysis to look for seasonality here. We could if we wanted to, but we can start by just visualizing it and seeing it on the screen. And you'll see some of that as I walk through scenarios. So finally, we have a bar chart that's going to show you, I'm going to expand this. And it's going to show you the number of overflows by cause. And I can also change this parameter to show municipality or facility, to show the collection system, the watershed. And keep in mind, you're seeing anonymized labels here. The data isn't that dirty. These are intentionally anonymized. So I'll flip back to cause. I'll minimize this. I just also wanted to point out we've got some KPIs, or key performance indicators, on the very right side of the screen that give you a sense of aggregate numbers for the entire data set. So as I indicated, we're looking at about 20,000, it's actually more like 18,700 overflows, 333 locations, and billions of gallons. Okay, we can also use these filters sort of one-off to look at a particular municipality or a particular cause, year or month discovered. But as you'll see in a minute, I can do that by visually clicking and interacting with these visualizations themselves. I don't have to use box filters, which makes it very intuitive. So now that I've oriented you towards what's available on the screen, I'll walk through a couple of scenarios. So first of all, I just want to draw your attention to this huge red bubble here. You may have been looking at it the whole time. If you're anything like Deb, he said, my engineering eye just wants to know what that is. It might be an outlier, it might be real, but finally we're going to dig into it. So it's very easy to do using modern tools. I can simply click the map, and I can circle this geopoint here. And I'll apply that as a filter, and just to make it clear, I've now selected just a few postal codes that I wanted to dig deeper into, 8 to be exact. And I've filtered everything on the screen by those postal codes. So now my trend, my two-dimensional heat map, and my bar chart are all going to reflect just those postal codes as well as the KPIs on the right-hand side of the screen here. So right away, I can see that for these areas that I was interested in looking at, the number of overflows appears to be decreasing, with the exception of 2016. There was a little bit of an increase. But overall, the linear trend is downward, it's decreasing. So, you know, if I was interested in this area and it was really difficult to put this analysis together, I could stop there and say, we had a problem, it seems to be improving. I can think of maybe some anecdotal reasons why it's improving and stop there. But since we have modern tools and the ability to dive deeper into the information at our fingertips, you don't have to stop there. So if we go up to the two-dimensional heat map, we can see that you can kind of start to see that from 2006 to about 2012, we had a lot of overflows occurring throughout the year. But after 2012, they started to decrease a little bit in the beginning of the year and the end of the year. But we still have a persistent seasonal problem in late spring and early summer. So if I even just isolate these years by just, you know, visually interacting here, it becomes even more apparent that, wait, there's still a problem here. So this decreasing linear trend tells a very different story from this isolated, seasonal, persistent issue. So as somebody who is potentially trying to address and plan and invest in fixing the problems in these areas or getting ahead of them, this could be really valuable information. Furthermore, we can look at the causes associated with the what appear to be a persistent seasonal trend. And it's no surprise in this particular geography, at least, that the leading cause is precipitation. That makes sense because it's a seasonal problem. The leading cause is precipitation. Maybe we anecdotally knew that, but it might have been difficult to help others understand that in order to maybe secure funding or support in order to actually do something about the problem. So now, within a matter of minutes, I've been able to walk through with a few clicks and have a really clear case as to what's going on in this area. And I'll draw your attention, too, to the bar chart. This makes a point about the data quality, that we didn't need pristine data to get to this very powerful conclusion, that the second leading cause of overflows in this area is excessive flow. So if I'm looking at this with no context of what I've previously shown, just as a separate category in the data set, I'm thinking, what do they mean by excessive flow? Was it caused by precipitation? Was it caused by something else? Are these one and the same? Do I lump them together? Do I keep them separate? My data analyst brain is going in so many different directions. But it doesn't matter for the conclusion that I've drawn here. I didn't need to have that analysis paralysis and thought process in trying to clean up these categories and make them into something meaningful. I can just draw my conclusion and move on here. And I just really want to quickly return to the idea that, wait, maybe we're skeptical that this is actually an outlier. How are we positive that we can rely on this as a result? It is, after all, a self-reported data set. Anything could be in there. Somebody could key in 9 extra zeros, and that's the issue. But I can simply tab right over to the details of the data set. Not the prettiest view, it's not one we want to show right off the bat, but it's very useful when I want to dig into the details and ensure that something isn't an outlier. And I can see here that I've got the events for a particular location. Keep in mind they're anonymized, so you're seeing kind of random numbers here. And the date discovered, some other accompanying information, and then the sum in gallons for the events that happened in those locations. So I don't see any rows here that stand out to me as being very obvious outliers. They're all relatively high magnitude, and there are a lot of them. I don't see one row that's like 6 billion. So to me, this is not an outlier, and I can confidently rely on the data to make some conclusions. So with that example, I just want to check on time here really quickly before I go into my next example. So I'm going to clear all the filters. And you see the dashboard looks like it did in the very beginning. So I'll draw your attention back to the map. And we can see I dived into this area. I was interested here. Maybe I want to dive into this area. I'm not sure. I can go there later. But something that strikes me as interesting is that currently I've set the threshold of overflows, turn the bubbles bright red, I set it at 300. So let's say that's objectively quite bad. Anything over 100 is terrible. So in for my analysis, in my opinion, as somebody using this data, so let's say I want to lower the threshold and see what jumps out at me. So I can do that here. And if you we're noticing the map, this cluster of bubbles turned much brighter red and much more profound. So I'll do that again really quickly just to make sure it's apparent. But if I change it back, it tells me very clearly, like, okay, beyond this isolated area and this isolated area, you've got a lot going on right here. So let's expand the map and see what exactly is going on. So I can zoom in, and I can circle. You know, I could select each one, but I could also just circle them to get a better sense. Maybe I want that one. Drawing a pretty lopsided circle here, but as long as it connects, they're all selected. Okay, so I've selected those geo points, and wow, the dashboard looks much different. I can see right off the bat that it looks like after 2011, there was a huge uptick in tool overflows for these particular areas. That's also evident in the heat map, that there was almost no activity throughout the year, and then suddenly, all throughout the year, there was a lot of activity. This is where domain expertise comes into play in analyzing these types of data sets. So they can be dirty and not pristine, but then you have to have somebody with the right domain expertise kind of challenging them and poking holes, which I don't think is a problem or a challenge in this industry. So let's say a domain expert said, hey, you can't look at anything before 2012, because I know for a fact that the facilities just started reporting more after 2012 due to increased regulatory requirements and more accountability and just having more discipline and responsibility. So let's say we just want to look at 2012 and beyond, because that's more of a fair trend assessment. Anything before that in these specific geolocations is not really fair game. It wasn't fully reported, et cetera. So I can apply that as a filter. And now I'm just looking at recent years. And I can see that in this area, there's obviously been some problems, but the overflow volume is decreasing. Well, that's great. Once again, I could stop here and say, all right, we had a problem, it's decreasing year over year, but I have two more dimensions to look at that make me want to go a little bit further. First of all, I can look at cause. Let's break it down by cause. So the leading cause in this area of overflows is very different than what we previously saw. It's actually grease. So if I click grease, I apply that as a filter. Actually, I'm just going to X out of this so you can see everything change as I do it. So let's say I just want to look at grease-related overflows in this area. It's a little bit different story as if I were looking at all overflows in this area. So let's stick with the grease example. And let's say that I am a facility and I have been communicating with the public about the adverse effects of pouring grease down the drain. It causes sewer overflows. We're really trying to get people to stop doing that, to be more aware. It's especially a problem in the beginning of the year, the end of the year. Let's say I started amping up that public outreach and that communication in 2015, and we see profound impacts starting in 2017. So for anybody who's wondering, should we reinvest in that public outreach program? Is it working? Yes, overflows are going down, but is it really related to that? This is just another mechanism to make that point clear. So again, with prioritizing investment and just managing assets, these types of tools can be pretty powerful vehicles. So I'll look at just a couple more things. If I look at the next leading cause, it's roots. And no surprise, it's going to tell me something a little bit different than what I saw when I looked at grease as the leading cause. So the geographic areas affected by root-related overflows are different. The trend is different. It's stationary from a linear perspective. It's not decreasing. The seasonality is very different. And so it's important to just be able to really quickly isolate these leading causes, because each one should be looked at individually and perhaps addressed individually as a cause. I just want to make one more point to you all about the dirty data that we've been mentioning again and again. That having the dirty data set didn't stop us from exploring and getting value from the data. So I just popped open the bar chart showing all the causes available in the data set. So this is a free-form field, obviously. I have stream erosion spelled a couple of different ways, pump failure spelled a couple of different ways. I have info and infiltration, and INI, same thing, just spelled differently. So again, if I'm looking at just these labels in an Excel-based data set, and I haven't had a way to quickly graph them like this, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, there's no way, there's hundreds of these, thousands of them. There's no way that we can get any meaningful conclusions out of these without going through every single one and trying to group them together and creating very clear categories. Well, that would have been a terrible mistake to do and stop there, because as we can see, going back to Doug's point about directional correctness as opposed to transactional accuracy, the trends are directionally correct, and they're very clear. And we don't need to worry about, you know, well, what if this bar was 1/10 of an inch higher? It doesn't matter. It's the second leading cause. It's not the most leading cause, especially within a different geography. These causes change. So the point is that we're able with dirty data to get directionally accurate and very powerful conclusions. So with that, I will turn it over to our slides again, just to confirm you can see the slides, right, Doug? Okay. Okay,
maybe
great.
Maybe we can, but I'm going to switch one quick view on you because we're going to, we actually
okay,
see
maybe
a different
you can, maybe you can take that.
Yeah, I'm going to stop this. I'm going to hide this. We're going to get those slides back up. No problem. And
right.
So I moved us forward to the end of your demonstration content.
Awesome. Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay, so with that, I hope that giving you the demonstration gave you an idea about what is possible. That was obviously not an abandoned mine data set, but it's an environmental data set, and we hope that we were able to draw some parallels. And we'd like to kind of put it to our audience. How can we help agencies with their interest in utilizing data analytics at abandoned mine sites by identifying potential data sources that could be leveraged to turn information into insight? So we are really asking you to imagine the possibilities. So if you can, you know, consider, are there data sources out there that can be analyzed and explored in real time in order to perform analyses like assessing potential risks across multiple parameters, looking at physical and chemical changes along different timescales and seasons, or looking at potential impacts from wildfires and flooding? Any type of analysis that you can imagine that would be valuable to the abandoned mine space, we want to put it to our audience to consider that. With that, Jean, I believe it's time for questions. So,
that's right.
And yeah.
So thanks, Katie. Boy, this sounds like a really powerful tool. You know, I'd love to hear from the participants. If they could type in, if anyone has used this tool or has experience with this type of data analytics on a mine or mineral processing facility site, we would love to hear from you. So if you have any experience, please respond in the Q&A section. Katie, I do have one question for you.
Sure.
Can you provide a little bit more information about the software? What exactly is that software that you're using to do this data analytics?
Oh, sure. So the software is called QuickSense, and it's one of the leading data visualization software packages available. Some folks might be familiar with Tableau or Power BI, which is a Microsoft product. They're really all comparable in the fact that they allow you to explore large, complex, robust data sets in real time with minimal effort.
Okay. Thanks. So I have a question kind of specific to mine and mineral processing. So it looks like you used a bunch of data that came from essentially a single source. So what if we wanted to bring in another data set? For example, you showed that sewer overflow was a leading cause under one set of scenarios. Could we pull in, for example, precipitation data for this area and then use that in the analysis?
We absolutely can, and it's so funny that you should ask, because we had attempted to do that at one point. And we did come up with a pretty good version of, you know, drawing parallels between the two data sets. But we decided to just leave this one, you know, more simple just to the point of demonstrating one data set. But as long as we have two common points between two data sets, you can model them together on that common data point. So if you have a geographical point or a point in time or both, like a unique key, you can totally bring in as many as you have. Do you have anything to add to that?
No, and that's exactly the process that we look to do, is find the leading trend, the directionally correct trend, and then look for these external sources of data. Weather is one of the ones that's often at the top of the list, but there's other data aggregators out there that can provide other overlay data. So yeah, that's a big part of it, and a straightforward process with any of these tools. This is, as Katie mentioned, not tool specific.
Okay, great. All right, well, we do have a couple more questions. We will we'll come back around to those when we have some additional Q&A time at the end. But right now, I'd like to move to our next speaker. Thank you, Katie and Doug. That was really interesting. I'd like to move to our next speaker, and who will talk about metal transport in some watersheds. So, Hill, are you on the line?
Yes, sir.
Great. Let's get started then.
Okay. Hello, everyone. Good afternoon or good morning, whatever you are. As mentioned before, I will talk about metal partitioning and watershed, and I also will talk about large data set. And this particular data set is actually generated on the bench in our labs. My name is Suhail Al-Abid, and I'm with the Center of Environmental Solution Emergency Response, part of ORD, and I'm located in Cincinnati, Ohio. Today, the talk about the metal partitioning, with a focus on Superfund sites, became really important in these large watershed that is affected by such problems. How do we study the metal transport in such watershed? We will show today some examples of how we collect the data and what type of data, and then illustrate why a large data set, it's important to select appropriate remediation options or best management practices. Okay. So contamination generated in mines are a common problem in several regions in the U.S. and, of course, worldwide. But today my example is here in the U.S. There are about more than 500,000 abandoned mining sites just west of the Mississippi, but there's a lot of other abandoned mining sites with lots of issues, and that's part of the Superfund sites. Mining operations have left ores, waste materials, or we call it tailings, and exposing these materials to air, water, and the climate in general, and the biological interaction has caused a lot of weathering, whether it's physical or chemical. This weathering end up also affecting whether the contamination or in this case, the metal contamination is associated with particulate or dissolved metals. Sometimes heating some high concentration that affect the water resources and the way we use the water, whether it's for the drinking or for you know, fishery or any type, or even irrigation. Mine site remediation is challenging in many aspects, and the change of the climate, the change of the different hydrology in these watersheds, it does affect the water treatment design that is being used, and also what kind of aspect that we could do for these different sites. I don't see the arrow, but here we go. Thank you. So this is a good example here to show you. This is from the site I'm going to talk about. And in the left side, for example, you see these mine tailing or the process mineral processing waste that we call chalk piles. And if you look, it's everything pretty much dead, and you have a landscape looks like the moon. But then once that's removed, then you expose the soil that is below it, and as you see, it changing almost to a marsh-looking environment. And that's because the topsoil is all gone, and we're talking only about the parent materials and so on. So that big change, it does affect the mineralogy of the waste and then how aggressive some of these materials is being exposed into the environment. So why do we need metal partitioning? This is the issue that it's real important in these watersheds, since there is many creeks, there are rivers in these watersheds, and these streams could become a transport mechanism for a lot of these contamination, these metal contamination through the watershed. And the prevalence, one form or another, whether it's dissolved or particulate, to become extremely important in looking at long-term data, because that will help us at the end in finding solution for these sites. So the dissolved metal can be difficult to remove, typically required water treatment plants, and required some chemical and biological. Particulate metals, it could, because it does aggregate, it does precipitate. It's going to depend on the flow rates and of these waterways within the watershed. So it requires also a different type of management practices. So in finding solutions, why do we need a large data set? And that's one of the important aspects here that kind of relate to the previous talk about the necessity of having long-range data sets. In this case, is the statistics tell us that large sample size and the amount of sample events, the smaller the margin of error we'll have, and also it will include the variability for certain parameters, that those changes in these parameters will help us in deciding how we go about finding solutions. Oftentimes, we need to validate our assumption to avoid costly errors. Trial and error in a large site like this, based on very small data set, could be very costly, and it has a long range effect on the environment and also on the anthropogenic developments of this particular site. In finding these kind of solutions, this particular cartoon illustrates what is a part of the watershed that we actually need to look at. And this figure represents the physical mechanisms that involve the metal transport in the stream. If you see these red, for example, these are an example of a chat pile, anything that could be actually dragged from these chat files into these streams, it could either precipitate it as bed sediments, it could be partitioned into dissolved metals, or it could also stay as particulate, but a smaller size that could actually be transported from one area to the other. This is a very dynamic process, and most of these metals then could become bioavailable by this process, and it could actually affect the biota, or it could affect the human health. So the metal concentration in the bed sediment typically used to determine the metal mobility, and then the solid sediment concentration, which is what we call the SSC, is to calculate the suspended sediment loading in these streams. The reason for that, those particular sediments, they prone to transport much further in the watershed. The difference between total and dissolved concentration in the water can be used to obtain metal concentration in the suspended particles traveling in the stream. When using all these parameters, we have more complete pictures of how to make decisions about the remediation of the watershed. So now we're going to move to the example that I like to actually present here for you. And this is an area that it's what we call it a tri-state mining district. But today I'm just going to talk about Missouri and Kansas. It's Oklahoma that's also part of this. And we are considering this, in this study, there are seven tributaries, or creeks, if you will, into this particular watershed that end up in a lake that you see over here in this black circle. So most of the water that is actually collected in these watershed, where a lot of these mine tailing either still exists or has been removed, most of the water then is being collected and then end up in this particular in this particular lake, which is called Empire Lake. So the objective here then is to monitor the zinc transport. In this case, we are concentrating, at least in this talk, about the metal zinc. There are, of course, some other metals that is associated with this particular site, but for the time that we have for this talk, we'll concentrate only on the zinc. So for the scope then, the sample was collected in this site twice a month from 2014, 2018. We're still continuing with the monitoring, but the data that I'm going to show you today is for that period. Aqueous phase parameter and flow rate, suspended sediments, and solid phase parameters, they all were measured for this particular work. Okay, so this particular first graph, it's on the left here. It can show you the average flow rate and discharge sediments for each of these streams. The discharge is calculated by the flow rate times the suspended sediment concentration. So this is for the whole watershed for all the creeks that you see down in the x-axis. So all these tributaries on the left then, has been collecting a lot of these sediments based on the flow rate that it grows in there. The graph on the right shows the zinc concentration in these particular creeks. And as you see very clearly, that there is a partitioning through a dissolve, and there is also zinc in the suspended sediment loading. So what does that tell us? That tells us that each of these particular creeks, they have certain dynamic based on either physical or also the chemistry of whatever is the geochemistry of these particulates, and whether they partition into dissolved or is associated with the suspended loading. So now we move to the zinc in the water, and this is again the average for the left side graph. It shows the average of the dissolved and total in the stream sediments. And as you see from the averages, they do vary, again, based on what creek we're talking about, but it does not tell us about the variability. So it's very easy to look at this and you say, okay, well, Shorty Creek, for example, has a major issue, but does not really show you why is this changing is happening without a larger data set. And that's what you see on the graph on the right side, which show you the variability that exists for these particular creeks and how much that will actually affect the partitioning for the zinc between dissolved and total and what's in the particulate, and how much is this variation will then affect the decisions that we need to make about remediation of these particular sites. So this graph then zero in on this particular creek, which is Shorty Creek, and I took the same graph that you saw earlier, and as you see, the variation through time for that particular creek is very prominent. So again, that's another advantage of a large data set that actually we need to look at when we're finding solutions for the remediation of this particular watershed. Here's another example about Shorty Creek where you see the variability that does occur between total zinc and the dissolved zinc. This large data set just shows a lot of variability, but then when we narrow it down, we wanted to show is it in the suspended sediment or as zinc content. It shows that sometimes they line up with the zinc loading, the suspended sediment with the zinc loading, and sometimes they don't. So that means if they don't, like in this case here, that could be the dissolved fraction of the zinc for this particular creek. Okay, so now we're going to move to, we now know more about these creeks and how they behave and what is the zinc contamination in these creeks. So what are we going to do about that data? And this is where this slide shows that since we did understand the partitioning between aqueous phase, bed sediments, exposed surfaces, that there are several options that could be used to actually help removing some of these contamination from the water. And one of those could be adsorptive material, it could be sediment traps, it could be bioreactors, it could be several things. And today I'm going to focus on the using adsorptive material, which is the biochar. And to do this, you cannot, again, do the trial and error. You have to take the water chemistry specifically for the water stream. And in this case, again, we pick the Short Creek since it has the higher concentration, just to give you an example. We're trying it for the others, of course. But and to do this, you have to do some benchwork first, and then you move into the pilot scale and then eventually on the field scale. So to do this for the biochar, again, we needed to, if if we pick any of these particular materials, we need to understand more about what they are and how they made. Biochar is actually granulated carbon product. It's either sometimes even found naturally. Some of them are manufactured. And it has been used as soil amendment. It has very high porosity. So their pore volume is quite large for an absorptive material. And it could be also considered as beneficial use of waste. So you could take even like poultry litter and you can change it to a biochar, or you could take a lot of these burned forest large forest fires, for example, in Western United States. And that could generate a lot of biochar naturally that could be used for this particular purpose. All right, so now we move into if this material does work, how do we apply it? And this cartoon, again, takes that particular cross-section that I showed you earlier. And it shows you either could use it as trapping for the runoff reaching the creek. It could be put as what we call them tea bags, or the more technical term for them is in-stream adsorption bags. These are usually, you take these material, you put them in these bags that is made from geosynthetic material that is porous, and it allow a contact between the biochar and the water and the contaminated water. Or you can stack them in these different tea bags approach, if you will. Okay, so what is the characteristic of these different biochar? We look at these different ones from different manufacturers, and again, the cost to play a big role in these. That's why in any engineering approach, you have to include the cost of the material and how much you're going to use it and what purpose, and are they going to be effective for how long. So this is the bulk density, the porosity, and you see they vary between their surface area porosity and so on, but overall they all we all feel like they're all applicable for the purpose that we're trying to do. Okay, so to do this test, one of the things we did in this initial experiment is that we used batch test to find an optimum amount of the biochar to adsorb zinc, and we used actual water from the Short Creek at pH 7. And as you see, there are when the curve goes flat, there is no benefit of adding more sorbent. So that means that pretty much our optimum before it gets into the flat area of the curve. The Douglas fir biochar performed the best in this case, and it just showed that the final pH is also 8.4, which is good for keeping the zinc in the precipitated form rather than the dissolved. When we moved to the kinetic test, which is over time, we could see that it did reach the equilibrium around 24 hours. So it's fairly quick to actually adsorb the material, but then it flattened out. And that means in any design for amounts or recycling, if you will, of this material, putting in new ones, it's going to depend on the concentration and how fast it's going to absorb these contamination from the water. So in this case, it's about 24 hours, at least in the lab. When we did the isotherms on this, which is real important to determine the adsorption capacity, some of these biochar stood up for the higher absorption capacity, and some of them are less, and some of them, they were very low. So that means, again, that's another decision in the engineering of using this approach for remediation. And then finally, what we wanted to know, does this biochar actually absorb not only the dissolved but also the particulate? So what we did is we did an experiment here that we used dissolvent particulate of zinc only. This is without the sediments itself. And the way we distinguish between dissolvent particulate is by changing the pH, and we also change the concentration. And if you see here that there is a reduction in the pore volume of these of this particular biochar, which is the Cal forest, and by calculating the area under the curve here for each of these treatments. Well, what is this telling us? That this reduction, it's actually not only taking up the zinc as dissolved, but also as particulate. So that means there is a good option here for using these materials and this teabag approach or these particular absorptive material in stream or in situ. So giving all that information then, we have to look at these large sites in terms of how much data we can actually collect to understand the fate and transport of contamination, and how did they partition as far as dissolve and particulate. And then be innovative enough to, after understanding the condition of these contaminated watershed and these Superfund sites, is to be innovative enough to choose different best management practices. In this case, we use the biochar, and to actually start thinking about these problems in much more, if used that, you cannot apply the same thing everywhere in every site. So collecting specific site specific data sets for a specific site is the right way of approaching the problem and finding solutions. Finally, I'd like to recognize a lot of my colleagues that help out in this project. I work closely with Mark Johnson. He's another ORD scientist in Corvallis. Patricio Pinter, he's instrumental in a lot of the work that I do here in-house. He's with Pegasus Technical Service. I have Philip Potter, who's an ORISE postdoc, and Captain John McKiernan. He's also with us in the ORD, and he's part of the PHS group. I'd like to also recognize Steve Kemp from Region 7, and Elizabeth Hagenmeyer and Todd Campbell, and also Rob Weber, who is also with the ORD, but he's located in Region 7 in Kansas City. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Sohail. That was good. We did have a couple of questions that came in, a couple related to biochar. So you referred to one of the products as beetle kill biochar. Can you explain what that is?
The origin of these actually came from the USDA. What they do is actually they collect these in the different farm operations, if you will, where they have waste and then they heat it at different temperatures. And this particular one, it has, a certain, I don't have it in front of me, but it is a specific temperature that is being used for generating this this particular biochar.
Okay. Thank you. And kind of a follow-on question to the biochar. Is biochar available? I mean, where do you find this type of material? You showed four or five different types. Is it readily available for folks who might want to investigate this?
Yes, it's commercially available in some of them. And some of them, like I said, is generated by either certain agencies as research aspect. But they are, most of them are commercially available. And that's why I was mentioning about cost. Cost play a big role because to generate those, if, for example, you use high temperature, that means you're going to use more energy. And that means the cost is going to go up.
Okay. Okay. And then a final question. In your adsorption and kinetic tests, did you say that you used water from the site, or did you prepare laboratory solutions mimicking those water quality components?
The water that we used, it was a water from the creek, an actual water chemistry. The reason we did add some more zinc to it is because we wanted to test the capacity at a higher zinc loadings. And some of these zinc loadings, we did see them at least from our data that you saw earlier in the graphs. So it is a combination of the actual watershed data. And in addition to that, is a spiked water in certain treatments.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. If folks have additional questions, please pose them online, and we will get back around to them if we have some time at the end of the session. Thank you, Sahil.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, so I will be the last presenter, and I'm going to talk about a project that we did for EPA Region 8 site assessment team. And what we did is we prepared a three-dimensional visualization and analysis for a mine site out near Breckenridge, Colorado. And we called it the French Gulch site because it was on French Gulch. So what I'm going to talk about is I'm going to talk a little bit about the site background, where it's setted and all, as well as some of the project needs, some of the things that the project team wanted to see out of this 3D visualization. Most of the time I'll spend today is on the data sets themselves. That is, what data were available for the site layout and features, the geology, the mine itself, the mine infrastructure, as well as the water chemistry and hydrology. As I talk about these, I'll talk about some of the data sets, the origin of the data sets, as well as the challenges that we faced with using some of these data sets and some of the solutions that we found to using these. And finally, we'll take a look at the final product of this 3D visualization. Before we get going, I'd like to give a big thanks out to Cascade Technical Service, who actually provided, they prepared the 3D visualization for us to support EPA on this project. And they used a product called EVS, which is operated by CTech Studio. Okay. So the site, the Wellington and Oro mine site is located, let me grab my arrow here, there it is. The Wellington and Oro mine site is located just outside of Breckenridge, Colorado, in a valley, and it's on French Gulch, which flows from east to west. It then combines with Blue River and flows downstream into the Dillon Reservoir, which is a water supply for the city of Denver. couple of interesting things about this map. You'll see this is a USGS topo map. You'll see the stippled area, which is the dredged area in the stream bed here, as well as some along blue. You'll also notice that this USGS topo map created from a photo, air photo in 1982, shows that the city of Breckenridge had developed a little bit in this floodplain area by 1982. So here's an air photograph of the mine site area that we were working in. You can see the tailings piles, you can see some of the mine infrastructure, the shaft locations, and you can see the dredged area as well as the stream channel down here. So if we zoom out a little bit, let me show you a couple of other interesting things about this. Again, here's French Creek coming down here. You can see the dredged area. You can see where we placed the mine workings right in this area. But it's also interesting to note that this is a more recent air photograph, and the city of Breckenridge has developed much, much, much closer to the mine. So there's a potential impact for these homes from something that might be going on at the mine. A really interesting thing that we found, when you look at the close-up of this air photograph, you can see that the dredge direction came up the stream valley and then turned around and started headed back. And then if you look really closely in this circle, you'll see that the dredge itself came to rest in a small dredge pond. We thought that was pretty cool and historic looking. So a little bit about the site itself. The site we're looking at is a combination of two mines, the Wellington and Oro mines, that eventually grew together. They started out mining lead and zinc ore in the 1880s, and they operated until the 1970s, but most of the mining was completed by the 1950s. There's about 12 miles of mine workings. Most of it was below the valley floor. And they used a combination of underground mining as well as some placer mining in the stream to pull the ore out. They also produced a little bit of copper, silver, and gold. There were a lot of previous investigations that concluded that the mine pool was the primary source of contaminants in the seeps and in that are leading into French Creek. And there's a water treatment plant that treats some of these seeps, and it treats the acid rock drainage that's collected. Now, the surface water and groundwater are connected. They're all interconnected through the mine workings and a series of fractured bedrock and fault. So that made understanding of the hydrogeology and contaminant chemistry pretty complicated. The other thing that we found interesting was that originally the ore bodies were extracted from these mineralized zones along faults. But now these are no longer ore bodies worth money, but these are sources of contamination, and they also represent transport pathways for contaminants through the mine infrastructure and through the fault. So the project objectives were ultimately to create a 3D visualization. So for those of you who aren't familiar with 3D visualizations, I've shown a couple of examples over here on the right. On the top is a geologic visualization showing some layering at a site. And then below, some of you might be familiar with the more traditional plume maps that can be created using these 3D visualizations. So our objective was to construct a 3D VA that shows the geology, hydrogeology, and if possible, the contaminant distributions. But on top of that, to address the mine site features, including where the mine pool was and all the mine workings, some of the dredge operations, and the stream channels, fractures, faults, and any other features of the mine that might be important to understanding. Now, the site team wanted this 3D visualization so that they could get a better understanding of the CSM, that is to integrate or interconnect all the different aspects, the geology, hydrogeology, and chemistry into a single visualization package. And the site team was going to use this to make decisions about where to go next in their investigation and what the loading sources might be in French Gulch. They're also going to use this to determine what the feasibility of some additional remedial actions might be based on the interaction and availability of water in some of the subsurface mine workings. A second and just as important objective of this project was to provide a tool that the stakeholders could use to visualize the site and get an understanding of what might be going on. As I mentioned, the city of Breckenridge was very much involved with understanding the site conditions here, but they weren't necessarily geologists and scientists, so there had to be a good platform for everyone to understand what was going on at the site. So this slide talks about the process that's used for 3D visualization analysis. It comes directly from EPA's Best Practices for Site Characterization course. And let me walk through the process that's used to create a 3D VA. The first thing necessary is to really understand what the project goals are, what questions are to be answered. That is, that'll help drive what data sets we might need. The second is to acquire all this data and to review it, QC check it, and process the data. Now, this can take a tremendous amount of time, even if the data is already in databases. As our first speaker talked about, dirty data and data analytics can be a really important aspect of reviewing and managing the data. The third step is to create the databases from all this data, and from that, start developing individual visualizations of the geology, hydrogeology, and chemistry. And for us, we had an additional component of the mine features. Once we developed the individual components and checked with the site team that they were comfortable with those components, the next step would be to integrate the different components and to pull these components together into a single viewable structure that would help us understand the integration of these three different components. This will also help us identify some outliers and check to see if those outliers might be related to some other aspect of the components. And really the last step was to assess what this 3D represents. That is to take a holistic look at the integration of geology, chemistry, hydrology, and mine workings, and see what stories it tells, and then present the conclusions and recommendations to the stakeholder team. In our case, this was the project team. So we had a lot of data to look at here, but unfortunately, we had very little digital data, especially for the mine features in geology. Almost all the data that we had to work with to develop the framework of the geology and the framework of the mine infrastructure was from a 1934 USGS paper that was centered on the entire Breckenridge Mining District. There was a couple of great sections on the Oro and Wellington mines and how they were developed, but again, this was a 1934 paper that we had to read and pull from. We really didn't have any digital mine data. Near the end of the project, LIDAR data did become available, and we were able to incorporate that to enhance some of our QC and enhance the topography and understanding of some of the mine features. There was some hydrology data that had been generated starting as early as the 1980s from the EPA and USGS investigations of the mine. Most of the data was fairly sporadic with a short burst of intense activity at the end of the 1990s, but the water level data was not consistent either in the locations where the data was taken or consistent across 1980 through the current. So we didn't have a really good understanding of the long-term water level. Similarly, the chemistry data was a little bit sporadic, and most of it was focused on the surface water. So So, as I mentioned, most of our geology and mine infrastructure data came from this 1934 USGS paper, which was an excellent paper written by some pretty tremendous geologists. There were five plates in the back of that USGS paper that we used to generate most of the mine infrastructure data and a lot of the fault data also. So the first plate was what you see here in the top left, and it's what we call the spaghetti map. This is a single map that shows all the layers of both mines all on one map. But fortunately, we had another plate that went layer by layer, level by level for each mine, showing the geology, which in general is just the red and the green sections here, as well as the tunnels, the shafts, and all the mine workings. And we were able to digitize each and every one of these levels and place them up in their appropriate locations based on some of the other maps in these plates. Another set of data that we found in the plates were these geologic cross-sections. Again, they were really helpful, and they provided a general understanding of the geology as well as the location of some of the faults. There were some other cross-sections that were provided as part of the mine level maps. And you can see the level of detail that the geologist, the mapping that was done. We have some major faults here that were mapped here and here and here, but there's also a whole series of much smaller faults and very detailed geology that was provided that we had access to, but we had to digitize all this data. So the first thing we did was we took the cross sections and placed them in the appropriate locations on the topo map. And what we came up with was this construct of geologic cross sections that kind of circled around the Wellington and Oro mines, which are located right here in the center. We also placed the mine level maps in their correct orientation and digitized them to create the mine infrastructure. We also placed the cross sections that we saw associated with the different mine levels. We placed them in this 3D visualization. You can see that we have three or four of them in this figure here. So ultimately what we came up with, if you strip away all of the plates, is we came up with this picture of the mine infrastructure that was digitized from all those plates. In this figure, we show the mine infrastructure, that is the tunnels and stopes, just the tunnels here, but we also show some of the shafts, the Oro shaft, the Wellington shaft, the main shaft, and the number three shaft, which were important to understand their location and depth when we started talking about water level geology and movement of contaminants. So we talked about the faults. Well, faults were a pretty important component to the CSM according to the site team. We know that there were lots of faults at the site, and they had the potential for both transmitting contaminants as well as generating additional contaminant loads in the groundwater. Our first question was, could we even visualize these faults? We weren't sure if we could create faults in this 3D visualization package. So we tried a couple of different things. So in the picture on the right here, we show some of the major faults that were located at the site. For you geologists, the Bullhide Fault on the left and the Great Northern Fault on the right describe the graben, the faulted block down in the middle, where the mine was located. One of the most important faults that we looked at was this one in yellow that's called the 1110 fault. And it was important because it went through some of the most highly mineralized zones and also crossed the French Gulch approximately where we saw the highest loading content. And we wanted to make sure we could visualize that to help understand the integration of mine workings, faults, mineralized water, and surface water. So again, we went back to the only data set that we really had which was these wonderful cross-sections from those incredible geology maps that were created in 1920s and 1930s. So we took those maps and identified the location of the faults in each one of those maps, and we created these planar features along those fault planes that were identified in the cross-sections, and we linked them together as a plane, and were able to place them in the 3D. So here's a couple of examples. Here's one of the 1110 fault, and here's one on the left of a steeper fault. Now, one of the interesting things we observed was that the USGS surface map showed a different location at the surface of the 1110 fault from what we had interpreted based on the subsurface geologic cross-sections. We thought that was an important conclusion that the site team might want to understand. After we presented the information on the geology and faults, the site team thought that it might be important to understand the mined out areas, or the stopes. That might be important to the CSM, because some of these are going to be fully loaded with mineralized water and could represent long-term sources or additional source materials. So all we had was a couple of stope maps, three or four stope maps from the 1934 and a later 1950 USGS paper. And we took these maps and we rubber sheeted them into the 3D model. And we were able to place them in their approximate locations. Now, when we say rubber sheet, that means literally stretching parts of that map so it matched the other infrastructure that we had already developed. So we did this in a few places, and we came up with a combination of mine workings and stoped areas. The next thing we did was we developed the overburden geology. Now, the overburden geology was important because the dredged materials in alluvium could be a potential source, and it could be a transport pathway also. So we generated the alluvium extent and the depth of alluvium based on some boring logs as well as the USGS topo maps and some geologic maps. We also took the air photos and we looked very closely at them for outcrops so that we could very closely bound the alluvial materials within the stream valley. We also digitized the dredge material from the air photo, and using a technique I'll talk about in a little bit, we estimated the depth of the dredge material. So we were able to come up with a three-dimensional map. This is a contour map showing the thickness of the dredged material within the stream. So ultimately what we came up with was this three-dimensional view of the dredged material, the alluvium in the valley, and the bedrock. Now you can see from the upper right that the alluvial material is pretty shallow compared to the depth of the mine. The second component, or the third component we worked on, was the hydrology. We created a series of potentiometric surfaces from the synoptic water level readings that we had. There was a really good set of synoptic water levels between 1998 and 2000, but outside of that, it was pretty sporadic. So we didn't really have a good feeling for what was going on with the potentiometric surfaces other than through that time period. So to generate an average potentiometric surface for the mine, we took an average of all of the readings, potentiometrics, and generated a potentiometric surface using all the monitoring wells, and we generated this layer here. We also took a look at some of the individual water levels. For example, there was a lot of data for the Oro shaft over time. And one of the interesting things we noted is that there appeared between 1998 and 2000, there appeared to be about a 6-foot increase in water level. But unfortunately, we didn't have any data, any significant data after that, that we could ascertain whether or not that was just a localized temporal event or whether it was a longer term event. So we took that potentiometric surface map from the monitoring wells, which were centered in just a small area of the site, and we extrapolated that across the entire area, across the entire study area. And we placed that within the 3D visualization of the mine workings, and we colored the area below that potentiometric surface dark and the area above that light to indicate the areas that would likely be flooded, the levels that were likely flooded, versus the areas that might be accessible and unflooded. And finally, we took the surface water data, and there was quite a bit of surface water data, and we plotted each and every event over time. And we plotted the two primary contaminants of concern, cadmium and zinc, in the stream and shallow adjacent monitoring wells. And we created this visualization so the team could see the cleaner areas, that is less contaminated, the lighter, the cooler colors, and the darker or brighter colors where there were contaminants for both cadmium and zinc. And we did this for each monitoring event that we had. Now, I mentioned that most of the data was non-digital. There were a couple of interesting pieces of data that were really valuable to us in creating and quality checking this model. First of all, the mine level elevation and the extent. There was a table in the 1934 report that we could, that we used to generate the elevation of the entry points of these mine adits and levels. So that was really helpful in developing the mine infrastructure. But for the faults, we had some data from inside the mine levels created from the cross sections. But we needed some additional data to find out what the orientation was outside of where we had those cross sections. So when we looked in the report, we could see that there was some strike and dip information and some elevation differences and some thicknesses of some of these faults that we could use to quality check our data. That was really helpful in expanding and extrapolating the location and direction of these fault planes in 3D. The other really valuable piece of information came from a 1919 mining journal. And it indicated that the depth to bedrock in the main channel was about 45 to 50 feet. And that was really valuable because we had essentially no geophysics data and no mine boring data, geologic boring data within the dredged area to estimate the depth to bedrock. So using this 45 to 50 feet, we were able to generate that 3D visualization. But there was a lot of important data that we couldn't include in the 3D visualization that was really helpful to the CSM. For example, the USGS had done a number of tracer tests to look at the groundwater flow directions and the different impacts of surface water and runoff. We weren't able to incorporate that easily into this particular model, but it was valuable in an interpretation. Similarly, there were some water temperature data from the deeper mine shafts, but we couldn't really find a good way to present that data because there wasn't enough of it. It was limited spatially and temporally, so we didn't have a good story to tell with that data. Now, the geology data, as you saw, there was a tremendous complex mineralogy associated with this mine, with the number of different mineralogical zones and the different geologic formations. And we weren't able to reasonably correlate all of these different geologic layers like you would normally do in an alluvial section if you were doing a traditional contaminant transport 3D VA. And the level of detail of the geology and the changes in geology was really not necessary. The site team didn't feel like it was a significant contributing factor to something that they wanted to look at. But there were some interpretations that were used to support our visualization. For example, knowing that the mine and the alluvium were hydraulically connected was really valuable to allow us to extrapolate the potentiometric surface across the entire study area throughout the mine. Similarly, knowing that there was drawdown across the 1110 fault told us that that was not a bounding fault, but it was transmissive, and that we could create a cross-section, we could create a potentiometric surface that went across that with no perturbations. So the final product that we had for the team was a visualization package that included the four components, as well as an integrated visualization and a tech memo that explained how we came up with this and what was in that 3D VA. A couple of other useful products that came out of it were a presentation to the stakeholders using this 3D VA to help them better understand the site, and a database. Since we spent so much time cleaning up the monitoring well and chemistry database, this was a great starting point to support EPA and USGS studies that were going to occur. And finally, we did create some PDFs. They're actually 3D PDFs, similar to the product I'm going to show you in just a minute, that could be used in meetings, reports, and other communications. Okay, Gene, I'm going to switch over and do a quick walkthrough of the final product. There we go.
And again, yep, your FOREDIM is up, and I'll just remind the live audience, you each have individual controls in the upper right window of the space where Jim is showing his screen that you can also zoom in and maximize or enlarge the content for better viewing. Go ahead, Jim.
All right. So I'm just going to walk quickly through this final integrated 3D VA that we had. So we draped the air photo over the LIDAR imagery in here. And then we'll step through the different stages of the 3D VA that we provided the client with. So this is a depiction of the alluvium. And if you look at it from the side, you can see the thickness of the alluvium over here on the right-hand side. And then you can see the fault. We laid the surface location of the fault. And we also showed the 3D planar surfaces of the fault in the subsurface. And we added each fault individually so the teams could view the significance of each fault and take them on and off at their leisure. Again, that shows the bounding graben faults. And then we added the mine infrastructure, including the stoped areas. So if you turn it sideways, and you can manipulate this, you can expand it. You can see how the mine infrastructure is related to the faults and the alluvium. On top of that, we placed all the mine, the monitoring wells that were at the site, and they're indicated in yellow here. We showed the depth, the total depth of the well, as well as any screened intervals. There's another shot showing the dredged materials. Again, looking at it from the edge, you can look at the 3D version and see how that dredged material relates to the stream and the faults. And then we placed the chemistry data for the stream and the monitoring wells, identifying each individual point where chemistry data was taken. So this is for zinc, and then we added the cadmium data. And ultimately, this was the final integrated 3D VA that the team could use to evaluate what steps they would take next for investigation and remediation. All right, Gene, that concludes my presentation on three-dimensional visualization. I'd be happy to entertain any questions that folks have.
Okay. I'll remind everyone that that Q&A window is available in the lower right corner of your screen. We did get a few of them that came in while you were presenting. So, Jim, I'll just read one or two out while you're kind of getting reoriented in the environment. A number of people have asked about the software that you used for that visualization. So they were interested if you could confirm or repeat the name of the software and if it's proprietary.
Sure. So it's a commercial software. It's called EVS, and it's produced by a company called C-Tech Studios. It's a basic software package that was originally designed for the mining industry for mapping ore bodies. It's extremely sophisticated. It's very statistically, you really need an expert to run it. It's not a simple program. There's a lot of add-ons you can do, and there's a lot of proprietary modules that people generate to help facilitate developing these different models. But it is a commercially available software with software licensing, and it's not cheap. It's a very sophisticated product.
Okay. Could you talk a little bit about the amount of time it took to complete this project? There were a number
sure.
of people who commented on that digitizing element and that could have taken them years if they had to do that. So any info on the resources or time required to do it?
Sure. So you're right. The digitizing was pretty intensive, although it wasn't the digitizing itself, because once you have a map laid out on a table and you have your digitizer, you can just zip right through them pretty quickly. There were a lot of them, so it did take some time. What really took the time was making sure that all of the layers lined up with each other in the 3D space. So that did take many, many hours. Also, data cleanup for this particular site took a long time. That is going through the databases, extracting data from reports. It took us 18 months or so to do the entire process, but we had a number of times where we had to stop for various things for months on end. But the key thing is that we always had a product, a component available for the site team to look at and respond to so that we could do our next phase of work. Hopefully that answered the question.
Yeah, I think it did. Could you go back to one of the illustrations? They are interested in what the axes were on the X, Y, and Z. They're specifically interested in some of the numbers or values, or they weren't sure if that was even relevant in the viewer that you were showing.
Ah, there we go. Yes, so actually it's quite relevant. The X and Y were actually state planar coordinates, and that was the basis of our developing these mine locations and getting everything properly geo-referenced. The Z is actually the elevations, a true elevation. Again, some from LIDAR and some from that table that indicated what the entry point elevation was for each of the mine levels. That was a great question, yeah.
Okay. And then we had a few other questions just sort of came in about the actual application in decision making. So they were wondering if you could give more detail on how your customer or whoever you built the visualization for was actually using it to make decisions when it came to characterization.
Right. So I can't really speak a lot to that. They're still in the process of determining what to do next, but it did give them some insights as to what areas they might want to focus on. For example, where the faults crossed the stream, those could be loading areas for contaminants, and those might be areas that they want to look at in more detail. in terms of optimizing and improving the collection and treatment of metal-laden waters, there may be some additional areas that they want to look at. For example, the fact that the 1110 fault as mapped was different from what we interpreted, that might give an idea of where there might be a secondary loading area into the alluvium or the stream that had not already been identified. And the site team could then do some borings or some investigative approaches to see if there were additional loading points to the system.
Okay, great. I don't see any other questions that are left in the queue here, except one last one that just came in terms of your data sources. So could you remind the audience where you pulled some of the information from that you were then stitching together in the visualization?
Sure. So for the mine workings, it was literally some plates, that is, paper copies of large maps that we then digitized. For the groundwater chemistry, water level data, these were Excel spreadsheets, databases, and cables from various reports that we pulled from USGS and EPA. It was quite a range of different types of data that had to get integrated together.
Okay, great. Thank you. I think in the interest of time, we might wrap up your specific question queue, and I'll sort of switch back to you and let you finish out with facilitation duties here.
Thanks. Boy, you're keeping me busy today, Jean. So we did have one question that came in regarding Katie and Doug's presentation on the tool. In terms of the outlier analysis, you talked a lot about dirty data. You know, correcting dirty data can be a real challenge. And you started an explanation of looking at your outlier analysis. Now, was that done manually, or did you have an algorithm that helped you identify those outlier data points or dirty data points?
So, just to clarify, this is a question related to Doug and I's presentation, right?
That's correct.
So we didn't have an algorithm to identify them. We identified them visually.
And to go a little deeper, we started by just doing frequency. Let's take that the item of the cause of an overflow. We first looked at just the frequency of occurrence and saw that rain, snow, sleet, and precipitation spelled four different ways were in the top 20. And so we grouped those together and did a few more of those groupings until the top 10 or so causes comprised 85-90+% of the data. And so everything else, in most cases, it was valid. It just wasn't standard. So it was something that, if it had rain, snow mix, that would have been valid. But there was no good way and no tool to match that in. But since with just a little bit of matching, we got to the vast majority of the data being in a small number of groups that we didn't need to go further.
Okay. Well, thanks. We did pose a question to the audience about any participants that might have used this tool, and we didn't get any responses from anyone who confirmed that they had used it. But it was interesting. We got a couple of responses from folks who said that they could imagine using the tool either for operational facilities to look at kind of ongoing issues, or even to look at the differences in evaluating natural versus mine-influenced metals or evaluating conditions over time. Does that sound like something that this tool might be suitable for?
I definitely, and the place where I could see that the most applicable would be, say, in one watershed where you had many sources that were changing over time, and you know, you might be collecting data at different time intervals and somewhat different contaminant analyses, but this ability to pull all these data sources together and look at a broader watershed-wide or even statewide change in loading, change in composition over time definitely would be.
Okay.
One of the other areas that tools like this have been used just in the natural environment is there's a case study about 3 years ago of Jakarta, Indonesia, which floods all the time, using Twitter to estimate flooding depths all over the city. So at first they just took natural Twitter, and then they made it kind of a civic duty to tweet about floods. And to take all of that and pull it all together to map out in a location where they just didn't have anything in the way of water height sensors that they could get, and it worked tremendously well. So I love people's thought, is there any way to garner additional information from citizen scientists and the public that we use through these sort of tools?
So it sounds like this data analytic tool could be used essentially real time in evaluating situations at mine sites.
If you've got the data set, definitely. That's the whole basis of this data exploration and the value of having a very wide data set with lots of different parameters. If you can just see what parameters tend to be influential, and definitely it could be real-time evaluation. It could be real-time evaluation informing, on-site analysis or other data collection methods. But one of the magic parts of these tools are everything, the tool itself, every data element is related to every other data element. So when you want to slice and dice differently, or if you want to put quantitative information into buckets of 0 to 100, 100 to 1,000, 1,000 to 10,000, all those sorts of things, there's just no back-end work to do. They're things that can be done on the fly very easily.
Yeah. Okay. If there's any other questions, I'd like to entertain them now. I don't see anything else. Oh, we did get a comment. It looks like Region 10 is developing a QuickSense tool to show where ORD research development products and projects are located and developed. So not only can you use this for site-specific, but it appears you can use it for programmatic tools also.
Yeah, definitely.
Great. Okay. Well, I don't see any additional questions coming in at this point. So, Jean, I think it's about time we can wrap up.
All right. Thank you very, very much. I think we'll go ahead and walk through our final reminders for today's session. This was session number 4 in the mining seminar series that was hosted by ORD's Office of Science Policy, and this is the last session in the series. So we want to thank everybody for joining us in these sessions that we've been hosting throughout October here on the Cleanup Information Network. I encourage you to stay connected with us by visiting us at cluin.org or signing up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. If you are interested in learning about related webinars on this topic or additional resources when it comes to characterizing and cleaning up contaminated sites. I will just go on and remind everybody that copies of the presentation material are currently posted on the seminar links or resources page. You can follow the links under related URLs. It's on the middle right of your screen. Click on the seminar resources link and then press the Browse To button to open it up. I've also included those in the Q&A window in the lower right corner. Contact information for our presenters and organizers can also be found there, and I will ask each of you to fill out our brief online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's session. one of the most common questions that I get about our sessions is if we offer credits or certificates. While we don't issue CEUs or PDHs, we do provide participation certificates when you submit a feedback form for the event. Two important things. Please be sure to enter your email address correctly to that feedback form and check the box at the very bottom of the feedback form. Then when you hit submit, you'll immediately have access to a certificate that looks something like this one, which will document your participation in that event. You can either save it or print it out for your own records. If you happen to participate in a group from a single conference room, each person can actually fill out that feedback form, even if they didn't register individually. So for those of you who organized a group together, I would encourage you to share the link to the seminar feedback form with others who joined you in your room so they can share their own feedback to get their own certificate for their records. If you're looking for CLP credits, you can certainly request them for today's session. Of course, all of the information you would need to request those credits in the FATAS system can be found on the seminar homepage, including the session title, the description, our dates, the number of points you could ask for, and then also we strongly encourage you to include a copy of either your registration email or the presentation materials when you submit your request with your certificate to fully document your participation in the session. And so today's session, as I noted earlier, was recorded. You'll automatically receive an email as soon as that archive is available for on-demand playback. So I encourage you to keep your eyes peeled for that email. It'll come out in about a week or so. And then we'll also be sure to include links to the other sessions in the series so that you can catch up on all four parts in one message from us. So with that, I'll thank our presenters who took time out of their schedules to share their expertise, as well as of our organizers for helping to pull together today's session. And I want to thank the nearly 100 individuals who joined us for today's